You. Today, Die Glocke by Kelsey Bowman. Die Glocke is German for the bell and is the story of the Nazi bell experiments. Come with us on a journey through You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Yes, you are. So, let's get to chapter 9. So we're on, this is part 4 of Die Glocke by Kelsey Bowman. And, based on a real thing that happened, and a very, very large event. Chapter 9. Running Through the Woods. In the monks... good start. In the months after returning from their visit to Berlin, Helga and Sieger took up jogging. They were both health nuts, eating right, exercising, keeping their bodies young and strong. The slopes of Owl Mountain offered a daily challenge for them to climb. They would run in any weather, rain, snow, hot or cold, they were always together. The adrenaline from a good run helped them deal with the stress, the secrets, and the death. Today, they would decide to run off the beaten path. They pranced through the woods like wild deer, jumping and sprinting. After running a zigzag pattern down the mountain slopes, the two stopped for a breather and a refreshing drink of fresh mountain spring water. A small brook, branching off the main waterway, offers such an opportunity. Sieger kneels to fill up his canteen. Helga joins him.
Where do you want to go from here, Rudolf?
Anywhere you want, baby.
How about we make our way to the base of the mountain and check out the airstrip?
There's an airstrip down there?
Yes, Rudolf. You must know of it.
Actually, no, I don't.
So, I know something about this place that you don't.
Ha ha! Not for long, he takes off running through the forest. She joins into this last one. There is a rotten egg race, but there's a great distance to their destination, and they come across obstacles that interrupt their journey. She catches up to Sieger a short time later. He's crouched down, hiding behind a large elm tree. He motions to Helga to stay still and be quiet. She gets low and creeps to Sieger's position. There, they observe a group of soldiers following commands. The commands are being shouted at by Eckert. He's directing them to dispose of materials.
Very those good. I don't need anyone finding out what we're doing.
Rudolf, what are they doing?
Helga whispered.
They're getting rid of something. Come on, let's move closer so we can see what's going on.
They slither like snakes to within yards of the activity. Sieger is impressed by her stealth. There is no doubt in Sieger's mind after witnessing her ability. She definitely has military training. They aren't shocked to see a mass grave of prisoners. They all appear dead for a long time, like weeks or days, the cause of death apparent. All died of a single gunshot wound to the head. The vast numbers of bodies is shocking as well. At least 24 from Sieger's first count. As the soldiers were completing the task of covering the doctor's crimes, as an unexpected guest arrived. The steel door is opened by a private, and out walks General Kammler.
Are you done yet, Doctor?
Just finishing, General.
Okay, everyone out of here now.
Now!
The SS cronies run frantically for the door. In seconds, they're gone. The General and Doctor, thinking they are alone, begin to have a conversation, revealing another piece of the puzzle of what was really going on around them.
Kammler, if this doesn't work, you and I are fucked.
It's not about the real weapons, anyways.
What do you mean it's not about the weapon?
How else are we going to win the war?
The war. Hitler ain't thinking about the war anymore. He's lost it. The guy's nuts. He mumbles about witches and secret pacts.
It has become about the bell and the power of red mercury that possesses his mind.
Then perhaps we should be making plans of our own.
Perhaps we should, my good doctor. The two dark figures stand over the freshly turned dirt. No tears shed, not a thought given for the dispatched souls. Like ghosts, they fade back into the recesses of their lair. Helga and Siga wait till the coast is clear and retreat to a position that they can convene in safety.
Helga, we should get back. Why, Rudolf, aren't you used to the strangeness of this place yet?
Yes, I guess I am. Well then, let's continue on. Why let it spoil the day? We can't do anything about it.
Siga realizes it sounds cold-hearted, but also realizes the truth behind it. So they run on, viewing the airstrip and making their way back to the sanctum of the castle walls. Not another word mentioned about what they saw and what they heard. Chapter 10. Symbols. Otto woke this morning, excited about the planned events of the day. His skinny frame sits at the edge of his bed. He yawns and rubs his hands through his thick brown short-cropped hair.
"Got to get ready," he says out loud.
From his room, he walks down a long hallway to the end, turns left, and enters the floor bathroom. The young man pulls back the shower curtain and turns the water on. Otto waits for the water to get hot. The room fills with the comfortable, steamy mist we are all accustomed to. As Otto stands in the shower stall with hot water pouring over his head and body, he thinks of Alfred. It's only been a few months since the tragic events of his death. Otto's mind sometimes fills with the flashes of that horrible night. The trigger for the memories this morning can be attributed to the planned events of the day. Today was the delivery of the replacement model of the bell. Sometime around 10 a.m. it would arrive. Siga told them after returning from Berlin that this model was built in another secret compound in the Forges of Scotland. No, in the fjords of Sweden. Secrets, too many secrets, he hears ring out in his mind. He is soon finished and ready for the day. Otto returns to his room, the morning sun shining into his small window and illuminating his tiny room. He takes a minute, pouring himself a cup of coffee from a kettle his mum gave him prior to the war. He managed to snag a small electric hot plate and each morning made this routine a ritual. The time used to clear his head and think about his daily plans. Otto sips his steaming black coffee, enjoying the peace and quiet. Meanwhile, in the main floor staff kitchen, Siga and the rest of the crew are already up and energized, eating and laughing.
Okay, today, the No Kronos member.
Okay, today, the new Kronos member model of the bell arrives. You guys are excited?
Absolutely, sir. We can't wait to get back to work.
Excited, I believe, but that last part I call bullshit, Zurich.
The group laugh. Just as then Otto enters the room.
Well, look who's decided to join us.
Sorry, sir, I'm running a little late.
It's okay, Otto. Still lots of time to get ready.
Relax. Grab some grub.
Yes, that's a needed thing.
Helga, being the sweetheart she is, grabs a plate from a nearby cupboard and gives Otto a hand.
Oh, thanks, Helga.
My pleasure, Otto. So what's your job today?
I think I'm inspecting the new unit for construction floors.
That's right, Siga replies. I want you to go over every inch of that machine. They never tested it, and really all we're getting is the shell. The turbine drives, the thermal expansion tanks still need to be installed. Kurt, you've been assigned the navigational upgrades and electrical systems. Yes, sir, Colonel. Kurt Davis, a nervous young lad, just like the rest of them, was given Alfred's responsibilities after his death. Surik, your orders are to produce another 6,000 pounds of red mercury. Not with Eckert, I hope, Colonel. Sorry, kid, but these orders are right from Kamla himself. That crazy shit will be unavoidable till the war is over. Helga, you can stay with me. I need your organizational skills to keep the machine going. What about Sporenberg, sir? Helga asks. He and Kamla will be at the castle till the Wunderwaffe is launched. Try to stay clear of them. Do what you're told. In other words, keep your noses clean. Yes, sir, the three SS officers reply. Breakfast is completely devoured in a timely manner. The last of their coffee gulped back, and they race off to the madness that is Die Glocke. When the five researchers arrive at the loading docks for the underground complex, they are greeted by the brass.
Colonel Siediger, there.
Colonel Sieger, good to see you.
Yes, you as well, General Sporenberg.
Sorry for arriving unannounced, Colonel, but I need to be spontaneous.
Understandable, General.
Kamla and Eckert will be arriving later today, noon or so.
Eckert was in Berlin?
Yes, we want answers on the Vril weapon. I want to see the results of their efforts for the past 2 years. Varna will be doing some demonstrations for General Kamla over the next several months. The Führer wants to see what the Vril weapon is capable of.
I'm assuming total destruction, sir?
Not exactly, Colonel. The Führer would like only the people gone, not their assets and infrastructure.
What type of weapon is capable of doing such a thing?
The radiation from the red mercury. Dr. Eckert has stumbled across some interesting results.
What type of results, sir?
I'm not exactly sure, Sieger, but based on my meeting yesterday, Eckert has found a way to destroy not only living tissue and not damage inanimate objects.
I thought he was developing an atomic weapon for delivery.
He's developing 3 or 4 alternative weapons. Hitler will decide which one is best. Your bell will only be responsible for delivery of this weapon with blitzkrieg speed and accuracy, Colonel.
Yes, sir. The Colonel and General talk amongst themselves for 20 minutes or so while waiting for delivery of their secret package.
Sieger questions Sporenberg in a very soft manner as to not arouse suspicions.
He needs to find out more on what Eckert's doing.
To no avail, the General seems tight-lipped. The dust can be seen rising over the treetops, and soon after, the rumble of a motorcade. The Colonel gathers his team.
Get ready, they're coming.
The three young men race to press the button that controls the massive steel entrance doors. Kurt gets there first, being the more physically fit than the other two. A good, strong lad, built like a brick shithouse, is the best description.
Yeah, like we had a chance of winning that race, Otto, Surik gasps between breaths.
The convoy of vehicles turns the corner. First the cars, some troop carriers, and then the bell. You could not see it. The middle truck of the convoy was covering something big. It had to be the bell. The vehicles spread out and clear a path for the truck to enter the tunnel. Several security personnel run behind the secret cargo, the last one hitting the button to close and seal the cargo inside.
General Sporenberg walks over to Sieger.
Okay, Sieger, get to work.
General Sporenberg.
Okay, Sieger, get to work. The Allies are coming, and we don't know when, and we don't know where, but they're coming.
The Dark Lord of the Nazi secret weapons programs is carried away in his chariot of blackness. He needs to find what he's really looking for. Sieger and Helga join their three other teammates at a side entrance door. Let's go in there.
Not so fast, Kurt, the Colonel says.
Yeah, guys, let's have a smoke first. It'll take them 20 minutes to get it unloaded and set up in our complex, Helga suggests.
Yeah, relax.
Okay, sir. What if you don't smoke?
Kurt's a non-smoker, everybody, Otto teases.
No one cares. They light up anyways and enjoy their last moments in daylight. Later that morning, when the veil was about to be drawn back for the first time on this duplicate unit, the group gathered in anticipation.
You guys take the honor, the colonel instructs.
They run forward, grabbing the tarp covering the bell. They pull with all their might. The tarp comes flying off, and there it is. The five stand in awe of the look. It resembled their unit, but different. Smoother and more acorn-shaped. Deeper brown in color, and no more Nazi emblems, but other symbols. To Zurich, Otto, and Kurtz, they were unidentifiable, but to the colonel they had deeper meaning. The Nazis educated all their officers in the Reich's history. To do that, one has to learn the roots of the national movement and the birth of the occult into the SS. Back in 1912, several German occultists with radical anti-Semitic inclinations decided to form a magic lodge, which they named the Order of Teutons. The main founders were Theodor Fritsch, a publisher of an anti-Semitic journal, and Philip Staff, a pupil of the racist Guido von Liszt. The Order of Teutons was organized along the lines of the Freemasons. Only persons who could fully document that they were of pure Aryan blood could be members. In 1915, they named Rudolf Freiherr von Sebutendorf Grand Master of the Bavarian Order, and from here he founded the Thule Society. The Thule Society eventually joined forces with the Vril Society, and before you knew it, had flying discs and bells and who knows what else. Seeger does not tell anyone the meaning of these symbols for weeks. Then, one night, while working alone with Otto, the colonel educated the young man on the secrets of the symbols and their meaning. I've been working with runes since I was a child.
Runes, sir? What are they? Otto questions the colonel's bizarre statement.
You've been staring at those symbols for 3 weeks now, boy, and you never ask yourself, what do they mean? The colonel points to the bell, raising his front young friends. The colonel points to the bell, raising his young friend.
Those? I thought I'd better not, sir.
Understandable.
Do you want to know about them?
Sure, it'll make the time pass easier, sir. I was introduced to their use at a family reunion. I'm of German heritage. I believe this is why I found a natural affinity to runes, although one certainly does not need to be German to use them. Runes are an oracle from which one seeks advice. They work best if you detail your current circumstances and then ask for a specific question. Rune readings are sometimes obscure. They hint towards answers, but you have to figure out the details.
That sounds confusing, sir.
Confusing? You'll love this next bit. The colonel spills the history taught to him as a boy in the national movement. Runic divination, or rune casting, is not fortune-telling in the same sense that one actually sees the future. Instead, runes give a person the means of analyzing the path that one is on and a likely outcome. The future is not fixed. It changes with everything one does. If one does not like the prediction, one can always change paths. Since ancient times, runes have been used with divination and magic, in addition to writing. The word rune actually means mystery, secret, or whisper. Each rune has esoteric meanings and prophecies associated with it, beyond its mundane meaning and fanatic value. Each translates into a word or a phrase signifying concepts important to the early peoples who used them, representing the forces of nature and mind. Each rune has a story attached to it, a relationship to a Norse god. Odin, the Norse high god of the Æsir, hung from the world tree, Yggdrasil, impaled upon his own spear for 9 days and nights, in order to gain the knowledge of runes. When the runes appeared below him, he reached down and took them up, and the runic knowledge gave him power. He later passed on this knowledge to the Vanir goddess Freya. She, in turn, taught him the magic of Sedr. Heimdall, the god who guarded the Rainbow Bridge, taught the runes to mankind. Runic alphabets first appeared among German tribes in Central and Eastern Europe. Some rune symbols are likely to have been acquired from other alphabets, such as the Greek, Etruscan, and early Roman. The colonel filled the night with this conversation, teaching Otto all there was to know of the mysterious symbols engraved in the bell's body. The markings on the craft were made of straight lines, like something from the late 3rd century AD. The colonel began to point and circle the craft. Otto listened and followed. The final result was Sigurd translating the symbols. All will bow to the Reich's power and glory. Hitler shall be the world's one true leader and master. Heil Hitler. They both stand there quiet, contemplating the haunting words that sprang from Sigurd's mouth. For the next 12 months, the young Otto would stare at this ominous message. Chapter 11. Hitler was nuts. What makes a man mad? Is he just born that way? Or does a lifetime of systemic abuses drive him insane? On April 6, 1919, in Bavaria, left-wing socialists and anarchists proclaimed the Bavarian Soviet Republic. The leaders of the revolution were a group of writers who had little idea of politics. The counter-revolutionary forces, the Whites, composed of various groups of decommissioned soldiers known as Freikorps, equipped and financed by the mysterious Thule Society, defeated the Bavarian Soviets within a matter of weeks. Many other decommissioned soldiers waited out the turbulence in barracks, Adolf Hitler among them. After the Bavarian Republic had been defeated, Hitler's superiors put him to work in the post-revolution investigating commission. His indictments injected ruthless efficiency into the kangaroo courts, as he fingered hundreds of non-commissioned officers and enlisted men who had sympathized with the communists and anarchists. He was then sent to attend special anti-communist training courses at the Berlin University. These were financed by private donors from the Thule Society. This led to an assignment in the intelligence division of the post-war army. His assignment to infiltrate groups that could organize the working classes while the communists were weak. On a September evening, Hitler turned up in the Starnecker Beer Hall. Several members of the German Workers' Party had gathered there. Hitler listened to the presentation by an engineer named Gottfried Feder, a Thule Society member. He talked of Jewish control over lending capital. When one of the other group members called for Bavaria to break away from the rest of Germany, Hitler's voice rose to action. The astonished audience stood in silence, while his aggressive remarks swept through the room. After Hitler had finished his rant, he was immediately asked to join the committee as its seventh member, responsible for propaganda. The madness started with espionage and a network of arms cash. The Thule Society groups became a nest of resistance, and eventually this resistance changed to the National Socialist German Worker Party, the Nazis. To go along with the new name, his mass movement also required a flag with a powerful symbol. Among many designs under consideration, Hitler chooses a red cloth with a white circle in the middle containing a black swastika. Forever this symbol would be burned into the chronicles of the world's history. The madness and sickness never to be matched again. Perhaps this decline into madness happens with triggers. Say perhaps the meeting of the right individuals at the right time. A union of evil. Each member unconsciously leading the other down a dark, unknown path. Later that year, Hitler met a man by the name of Dietrich. He was a wealthy publisher and editor-in-chief of an anti-Semitic journal. Dietrich was also a committed occultist and a master of magic. Perhaps this is what influences a sick mind, the allure of magic and grandeur. One night in 1920, the older Dietrich sits alone with his young apprentice. Adolf, do you know the history of Thule?
No, Dietrich, I do not.
Thule was a legendary island in the far north, similar to Atlantis, supposedly the center of a lost, high-level civilization. But not all secrets of that civilization had been completely wiped out. Those that remained are being guarded by ancient, highly intelligent beings. The truly initiated could establish contact with these beings by means of magical, mystical rituals. The masters, or ancients, allegedly would be able to endow the initiated with supernatural strength and energy. With the help of these energies, the goal of the initiated was to create a race of supermen called Aryan, and they would exterminate all inferior races. The young Hitler is mesmerized by the tale. It fills his mind and floods his dreams with visions of strange worlds and prospects of world domination. The seeds of the genocide to come begin to take root. Years later, Hitler would dedicate his book, Mein Kampf, to his teacher, Dietrich. A frequent visitor to Landsberg prison, where Hitler was writing Mein Kampf with the help of Rudolf Hess, was General Karl Haushofer, a university professor and director of the Munich Center of Geopolitics. Haushofer, Hitler and Hess had long conversations together. Hess also kept records of these conversations. Hitler's demands for German living space in the East at the expense of Slavic nations were based on the geopolitical theories of the learned professor. Haushofer was also inclined towards the esoteric. As military attaché in Japan, he had studied Zen Buddhism. He had also gone through initiations at the hands of Tibetan lamas. He became Hitler's second mentor, replacing Dietrich. In Berlin, Haushofer had founded the Luminous Lodge, or the Vril Society. The lodge's objective was to explore the origins of the Aryan race and to perform exercises in concentration to awaken the forces of Vril. Deeper, the young Adolf slips from the edge of this reality into the world of endless possibilities and a magical realm filled with gods and aliens. In 1933, the Nazi Party rapidly consolidated its power. In June of that year, Minister of the Interior Wilhelm Frick put in motion the passage of the Law for the Prevention of Hereditary Diseases in Posterity, the Sterilization Law. Architect of the law was Ernst Rudin, professor of psychiatry at the Munich University. A separate legal system was set up, consisted of hereditary health courts, which could decree sterilization against a person's will. By 1935, the Nuremberg Laws, intended to ensure the racial purity of the nation,
and was aimed specifically at the Jews. Sounds mad to any normal person. And to make this that much more insane, Hitler requests the creation of the T4 project. There is not a great deal known about the T4 compared to other aspects of Nazi Germany. T4 was the Führer's chancellery, and the initials came from the full address, which was Tiergartenstrasse 4, Berlin. Project T4 was fully integrated into the organizational structure of the Reich and fell under Section 11B known as the Mercy Death. Four cover organizations safeguarded the Project T4. The Realms Work Committee, in charge of collecting information on candidates for euthanasia from questionnaires sent to hospitals. The Realms Committee for Scientific Approach to Severe Illness Due to Hereditary Disorders, set up exclusively to apply euthanasia to children. The Charitable Company for the Transport of the Sick, which transported patients to the killing centers. And the Charitable Foundation for Institutional Care, in charge of final disposition of the victims' remains. Madness. The madness and horrible reality of all these forces came together one night deep in the Austrian woods. It was now 1938, and Hitler was about to take total control of Germany. Still, the cusp of power eluded him. He was so close, but yet so far. He stayed up days and nights contemplating his next political move. Exhausted, he called his friend Dietrich. Dietrich, I need you now. As quickly as the man can, he races across the city to his master, running through the door into Hitler's office.
What is it, my Führer?
Your real society has witches, right?
Not witches, sir. Mediums that guide and advise.
Witches, then. I want to see them right well, right now.
Right now, sir? It's a little late.
Screaming with the voice of a madman, now, I said, get it arranged now, or I'll have you killed.
My Führer, I apologize. Sorry, Dietrich. I've been under too much pressure lately. Now get it done, Dietrich.
Dietrich, now nervous, makes a call.
I don't care if they're all sleeping. Get them up and out into that cabin now. I'll have a plane out there in less than 2 hours. We'll be on it and Hitler's coming.
The response on the phone is silence.
Okay, I love it's done, but I like to know what end this is for.
Dietrich, I want to be blood bond to the Vril 7.
What?
I read of an ancient Vril ceremony that gives the participants endless power and protection.
Adolf, the ceremony of death is a double-edged sword. Great victory also comes with great loss. I need to rule Germany now, not tomorrow. I'll take any losses the gods offer.
Hitler makes a few calls, and before Dietrich knows, the room is filled with security detail.
Sir, your plane is ready, a private says.
Let's go, Dietrich.
They exit the room, and then the winds on destiny carry them to a meeting with Lucifer himself. They arrive by car around 2 a.m., the height of the witching hour. The small group of Nazis enter the cottage. It is dimly lit and warm. Firelight surrounds them. The Führer sets his eyes on 7 of the most beautiful women he has ever seen. Hair long like horsetails. He was immediately enchanted by the celestial beauties. The leader of the quorum instructs all to leave but Hitler. She takes him by his hand and leads him to the head of a large oak table in the center of the room.
Here, my Führer, sit here.
Thank you.
He sits and watches. They all join hands, including Hitler. He looks down and notices blood dripping from his palm. The blood bond already set into action without his knowledge.
The lovely blonde that guided him to his chair must have pricked him. The seven beauties chant to raise their spirits. It's not long before the room fills with strange voices, multiple mediums talking all at once. They tell Hitler of a faraway place and technology that can be built to take these seven women to their destination. All they require for payment of power is the Reich's total and complete support to build them the device and get them there. With the promise of total power, Hitler seals the blood bond with his words. As the last word falls from his mouth, the eight that form the circle stand vibrating, locked in some sort of trance. The lights flicker and the wind howls. It lasts minutes long enough for Hitler to see his path. The group breaks apart. They slump in their chairs as if they are intoxicated. Hitler is the first to recover. He stands, doesn't say a thing, just leaves. He enters the military limousine and sits next to Dietrich.
Are you okay, Adolf?
Yes, yes. Better than okay.
So, my Führer, did you get what you were looking for?
Yes.
I need to annex Austria.
For what, my Führer?
The Spear of Destiny. When I have this in my possession, I will rule the world. I will rule all.
Did the mediums tell you this?
No, Dietrich. I saw it with my own eyes. I was transported to a different plane of reality and shown my past, present, and future.
Hitler talked Dietrich's ear off all the way back to the runway. He told him of the alien technology the Vril had been collecting for the past 20 years, how it could aid the Reich in world domination. Dietrich, I was shown a scene of an early epoch, some 15 million years ago, during which a huge moon moved across the sky very near the Earth. Its gravitational attraction gave rise to a race of our ancestors, the Giants. These giants, which appear in the ancient Norse and Icelandic sagas, sleep, but still live. They are still alive. To us Nazis, they will be known as supermen. In one set of visions, Hitler said he was shown that they live beneath Teutonic mountains. Dietrich got quiet and listened. He could hear the madness in Hitler's voice. He was now a man consumed by visions. The car bounces and creaks as it travels down the forest road, the sun just rising as they drive onto the airfield. Fog rising from the ground surface gives the whole scene an eerie feeling. Five exit the Führer's limousine. Hitler commands two of the guards to secure Dietrich.
Adolf, what's going on? Dietrich asks while struggling with the guards that are grabbing him.
Sorry, my old friend, but the vision also showed me your true identity.
What are you talking about, Adolf?
You're Juden.
Kill this pig.
The men force Dietrich to his knees. The man whines and whimpers for his life. Not for long. A Luger placed to his head and trigger pulled without hesitation proved to Dietrich Hitler was nuts.
Chapter 12. Foo Fighters. Only a few years before Kenneth Arnold had his historic sighting of unknown flying objects that would be coined flying saucers by a news reporter in 1947. Another phenomenon was still mystifying researchers. During World War II, battles in the sky, American and British pilots were experiencing the Foo Fighter. These strange flying balls of light became a feared element of American and British pilots, as they would appear without warning and oftentimes complicate an already difficult mission. Even attempts by some U.S. pilots to ram them were in vain, as they could not match their speed or maneuverability. The planes in World War II basically used four types of fuel: jet fuel, rocket fuel, liquid oxygen, and electromagnetics. None of these fuels could be responsible for a plane to reach for over 2,000 kilometers per hour in that time. So what were these crafts using? Several theories were offered as to what these small, strange flying objects were. All of the pilots felt that the Foo Fighters were a secret product of the other side, some type of secret weapon with the ability to take out enemy planes. On a regular basis, the generals, Dr. Eckert and Seeger, would meet to discuss alternate technologies and the Vril weapon. Most of the alternative technologies were to deal with the propulsion systems capable of delivering a weapon of mass destruction. The 6 months previous, in the mountains of Austria, they discussed the Horten 229 bomber, a stealth plane under development by the Luftwaffe. Their meetings would happen in the most amazing locations. Today the team was standing on the deck of a U-2 submarine, surfaced in the waters of Norway. The ship's hull rises and falls with a stormy sea. The sea splashes skywards, and the ice droplets formed from the sea spray freeze to their coats.
"What are we doing here, bomberman?" Kamler asks. "We're about to see a Luftwaffe breakthrough in this flying disc technology."
He points to a backdrop of mountain peaks east of their location. It should be any time now. The cast of SS gaze with squinting eyes to the eastern horizon, the sky darkened by low cloud cover and drizzle.
"There, 2 o'clock,
Marshal Bormann points. Seeger focuses his vision to a mountainous peak as his 2 o'clock position. He can see a dot in his eye, and then two, then three. The objects seem to move in 30-degree angles. Soon the dots become bigger and bigger. Within a period of a few seconds, the objects cover a great distance and come to hover several hundred yards off their starboard side. The group of SS leaders stand in amazement, watching three disc craft pitch and yaw in the stormy afternoon sky.
"Bormann, what are they?" Sparrenberg asks.
"General, the Luftwaffe..." "There, General, the Luftwaffe calls them Foo Fighters, and so did the Allies."
Seeger listens for sounds from the floating discs. Nothing can be heard. No rotation is witnessed.
"What's their method of propulsion, Marshal?"
"We've managed to take yours and Dr. Eckert's research and develop an electric field propulsion system. It's not anti-gravity per se, but allows incredible speed and agility. Top performance speed is well over 2,000 miles per hour. The altitude capability is over 70,000 feet."
"Impressive, Marshal," Eckert responds.
The Marshal yells down at the entrance hatch of the submarine.
"Captain, radio the lead Foo and ask them to demonstrate the performance of these craft."
"Yes, sir,"
Captain responds.
"Where were these developed, Marshal?"
"The Nazis have created a South Pole base. The purpose of this base is twofold. Number one, a top-secret base for development of secret weapons, and two, to have an escape area for scientists if we lose the war."
The disc began to zigzag all over the sky, performing almost 90-degree turns, at times skimming the ocean waves. A visible discharge of light can be noticed as the craft gains power. The light, a phenomenon that occurs when you excite air molecules such as oxygen and nitrogen. The show lasts for 10 minutes before the three unworldly craft disappear over the mountaintops. The group of SS brass fight the motion of the sea to re-enter the submarine. Once inside, the entrance latch secured, the U-boat descends below the waves. Under the cover of 1,000 feet of water, the SS generals, Dr. Eckert and Colonel Seeger, discuss their next move. The sub's interior offers shelter from the cold and wet. The room they are led to is dark and cramped. They gather and sit at a table that almost fills the entire room. Tea and biscuits are handed out by the ship's cook.
Seeger, look what the Brits are calling our flying discs, Eskat calls out.
The colonel grabs the paper and reads out loud.
In this very article listed several foo fighter incidents in their investigations, but also stated that at least some of them were a metallic disc-shaped object.
As with any mystery, there would be numerous and varied explanations offered to explain the phenomena. Among these were an electrical discharge from the wings of the planes caused the sightings. Perhaps a rare type of ball lightning, or an unknown atmospheric anomaly. These theories are as good as any, but still fall short of explaining the mystery. There have been sightings of the so-called Foo Fighters throughout Norway and Antarctica. These strange balls of white light have been captured by many photographers and videographers around the world, but we have moved no closer to a solution. For now, the mystery of the Foo Fighters remains unsolved. Martin Bormann explains the Reich's situation.
The problem is the three discs you've seen are the only ones the Luftwaffe have. Production of these vehicles is intense, and right now we're only using them to scare and intimidate the enemy. In other words, we don't have enough of them to do any damage.
As the submarine cruises back to the secret naval base, deep in the fjords of Sweden, the SS lords of the Nazis' secret weapons program plan the future. A future of destruction and genocide. Chapter 13. Seven Celestial Beauties.
20-some years ago, Mrs. Goethe was quite the dish. Every bit as beautiful as Helga Vellum. It's funny how time can take things so beautiful and fade them away.
Seeger saw a picture of the young Anna Goethe while staying at Helga's parents' villa. That night, when he was shown the vision of aliens and racial war, she told the colonel of the real history and their ultimate goal. Shortly after World War I, occult groups were popping up all over Europe. The Vril Society was no exception. In the early 1900s, a gathering occurred in a small coffee shop in Vienna. Seven young, beautiful women were brought together, and the union of these souls could be described as a coven. 500 years ago, it would have been called witchcraft, but now they call it channeling. At first, none of these beauties could commune with nothing but together. Something special happened. That night, after coffee, the seven women retreated to a cottage deep in the Vienna forest. Glowing in candlelight, the women sat holding hands, encircling an ancient symbol, chanting ancient words. Their minds opened to a universal source of knowledge, and the answers came flooding in. Maria Orsic was a famous medium who had become the leader of the Vril Society. She was born in Vienna, Austria. Her father was a Croatian immigrant from Zagreb, her mother was from Vienna. Maria soon followed the German national movement, which was active at this time, because their main goal was to annex Austria with the German Reich. In 1919, Maria moved to München, Germany, to live with her boyfriend, who later became her fiancé. It is unknown whether they married or not, because they both mysteriously disappeared in 1945. All of them were young ladies, all were very beautiful, with very long hair. Maria was blonde and Anna was brown-haired. They'd had long horsetails, very uncommon hairstyle at that time.
They believe that their long hair acted as cosmic antenna to receive alien communication from beyond. In public, they hardly ever exhibited the hair in horsetail style, for other methods of identification of real members were used. They wore a disc which represented two mediums, Maria Orsich and Anna Goethe. A year after the seven met, in December of 1920, a small group of persons from the Thule, the Vril, and the men of the Black Stone rented a small forester's lodge in the vicinity of Berchtesgaden, Germany. Maria and Anna claimed to have received medium transmissions in a secret German Templar script, a language unknown to Maria. The message contained technical data for the construction of a flying machine. The seven women met regularly, enchanting the spirits to release their secrets. The secret far larger than any of them knew. These telepathic messages had their origin in Aldebaran, a solar system 68 light-years away in the constellation Taurus. They began to document these sessions, and before the girls knew it, they had two piles of paper. One with the Templar script and the other with the legible writing. Maria suspected the second pile would be written in an ancient Eastern language, and therefore could be aided by the Pan-Babylonists, a circle close to the Thule Society. It turned out the apparently mysterious language was actually ancient Sumerian, and hence the language of the ancient Babylonian culture founders. Anna helped translate the language and decipher the strange mental images of circular flight machine. The concept of this technology matured in this time and the following years. Due to financing difficulties, it took 3 years until the flying machine project started taking shape. By 1922, parts for the machine began arriving independently from various industrial sources, paid in full by the Thule and the Vril Society. No success ever achieved, but the images and information still trickled in for 20 years until whispers fell on Hitler's ears. On his first encounter with Maria and Anna, Hitler witnessed a weird voice identifying itself as Anquil from an alien race known as the Sumi. The Sumi were dwellers of a distant world which orbits the star Aldebaran in the constellation called Taurus the Bull. According to the voice, the Sumi were a humanoid race who had briefly colonized Earth 500 million years ago. The ruins of ancient Lhasa, Shurapak and Nippur in Iraq had been built by them. Those of them who survived the great flood of Utnapishtim, the deluge of Noah's Ark, had become the ancestors of the Aryan race. Hitler broke out into a rant while Maria was still in a trance demanding proof. She scribbled several lines of queer-looking marks. Those marks turned out to be ancient Sumerian characters, the language of the founders of the oldest Babylonian culture. In December 1943, Maria attended, together with Anna, a meeting held by the Vril at the seaside resort of Kolberg. The main purpose of the meeting was to deal with the Aldebaran project. The Vril mediums had received precise information regarding the habitable planets around the sun Aldebaran, and they were willing to plan a trip there. The project was discussed again on the 22nd of January 1944 in a meeting between Hitler, Kammler, and General Sporenberg. It was decided that the seven celestial beauties, better known as the Vril Seven, would be sent through a dimension channel independent of the speed of light to Aldebaran. According to Sporenberg, a first test flight in the dimensional channel took place in late 1944. The test flight almost ended in disaster, because after the flight, the bell looked as if it had been flying for 100 years. Its outer skin looked aged and had suffered damage in several places. Maria Orsich and Anna Goethe
along with the remaining celestial beauties, mysteriously disappeared in 1945. On the 11th of March 1945, an internal document of the Vril Society was sent to all its members. In it, a letter written by Maria Orsech. The letter ends, "Nemend blibt hier." This translates to, "No one is staying here." This was the last announcement from the Vril Society, and since then, no one heard again from Maria or the rest of the women. It is speculated the seven celestial beauties escaped to Aldebaran. Chapter 14. Spooky Physics. It's Wednesday, and time for Seeger and Eckert to discuss the theory that's responsible for the Bell's propulsion system. They've been doing this for several months, trying to understand this technology. Today, Dr. Eckert has brought a science journal. Science America is the name the doctor keeps calling it. He opens it to a page and throws it on the table's surface. Seeger gives this a read. I think you'll find this very interesting. The colonel begins the task, and as he's reading the article titled Spooky Physics, Eckert is gabbing in the background. Strange events that Einstein called spooky might happen at least 10,000 times the speed of light. Atoms, electrons, and the rest of the infinitesimal tiny building blocks of the universe can behave rather bizarrely, going completely against the way life as we normally experience it. For example, objects can sometimes be said to exist at two or more places at the same time, or spin in opposite directions simultaneously. One consequence of this murky realm of quantum physics is that objects can get linked together, such that what happens to one instantaneously has an effect on the other. This holds true no matter how far apart these objects are from each other. What? Oh, sorry. Sorry, that should have been Eckert. This is not what he was reading. All right. So that was Eckert's voice. Anyway. What was that, Eckert? I'm trying to read this. Just ignore me, Colonel. Yeah, I was. Seeger hurries to finish reading the article. Okay, Doctor, what were you saying? Time travel. What are you talking about, Doctor? We've stumbled across time tunneling, Seeger. The Colonel stops and thinks of the strange events he himself witnessed during the Bell tests.
That's impossible.
Improbable, not impossible, Seeger. If we are producing particles in that move thousands of times faster than the speed of light, then time displacement is possible.
I still don't believe it, Doctor.
What? You read the article. It's only a theory, Eckert. Seeger, remember the early test models of the Bell?
Yes, how could I forget?
What happened to them, Seeger?
They shot off to some unknown location. Probably the middle of the Atlantic.
Or we shot them into the future and they haven't shown up yet. What about the units that disappeared from the visual spectrum for 10 seconds?
What about them, Doctor?
We didn't make them invisible. We sent them 10 seconds into the future.
Impossible.
I tell you, Colonel, it is possible. The torsion fields produced by this Bell isolate the machine from our space-time continuum, forming a tunnel that opens up at some point in the future.
So if we bend light, then we bend space. If we bend space, then we distort time.
That's the ticket, Colonel.
The Vril Society will be very pleased with this realization, Doctor.
What do you mean, the Vril? What about the Nazis?
Yes, Doctor, I misspoke. I meant the Nazi Party.
Seeger almost forgot that the good doctor knew nothing of the Vril and their plan to travel to the distant stars. When he first heard the story from Anna Goethe, he thought it all nonsense. With this development, the possibility of dimensional propulsion systems were a reality. In fact, the Bell was a time machine. They now knew that the forces responsible for the Bell's propulsion were particles capable of warping time and space.
Doctor, you said the future was about the past.
asked Seeger. This is all serious, Seeger, but the time tunnel form seems to, for lack of a better term, slope to the future. The only possibility within the confines of the spooky physics theory is if a porthole is formed using the red mercury.
How?
The red mercury, when formed, is linked subatomically. And as this theory states, what you do for one particle affects the others regardless of distance between them. Perhaps this applies to time as well, Seeger.
So you're saying if two field generators were started simultaneously using red mercury from the same production batches, if one of these generators were sent into the future, the other kept in the past, we would have a gateway from that future point to now.
Yes, Colonel. A form of time travel to the past. But without this jump-off point, one theoretically can only jump forwards in time.
The two argue back and forth for hours over different points of Einstein's article. It's at the end of this meeting that the crazy doctor gives Mount Owl its most ominous nickname. The conversation ends up with Eckert saying, "Come on, Seeger, let's get back to Spook Hill."
You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.